I am a pantser, as you know, that some people call it. I just write, but I know what my subject, my story is going to be, especially because they're historical fiction. And I'm go and all of all, by the way, the first three novels are all based on real life bankers' graves, what they call bankers' graves. Like prominent bankers are murdered, and they're unsolved murders. So Louise Moscow tries to solve these murders, and you know, I have my own theories and all of that. But anyway, so I kind of know where the yellow brick road is leading, but I just pants and I just write what I, you know, what comes to my mind. I always, in the morning, I meditate first, and I always get a lot of great thoughts that come to me and solve problems in my, you know, storylines and things like that through meditation. And then I always strictly sit down, and I'm gonna try to write 1,000 or 2,000 a day. You know, whether I reach it or not, I know it's productive. So that's mine. You know, that's my process. I really make it a discipline, and like I have an office, and I sit in the office and I write. So that's, I think a lot of people do that. A lot of people who finish novels, who finish whole novels that they write. I used to have to go away and be on the beach. I used to go down to like Newport Beach and rent a VRBO for a week and write. I needed to be focused, but now I can write in a cafe with noise. I can write anywhere now, but as long as I'm writing, you know.
On that note, Lorraine Ivanoff, I want to thank you very much for joining us on Politics or Pedagogy.
You're very welcome.
This is John Crumshaw with a special Politics or Pedagogy Education Report.
On KPFK, you hear more than a soundbite. That's education. That's our mission.
Please make your contribution at 818-985-5735 or pledge online at kpfk.org.
Yo, this is your brother Speech from the crew Arrested Development. You rocking with KPFK 90.7, Los Angeles.
Good afternoon and welcome to Middle East in Focus. I'm Esty Chandler. This week, Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu authorized a military operation to take over Gaza City. Days later, famine was officially declared in parts of northern Gaza, including Gaza City, by the world's leading authority on hunger, the Integrated Food Security Phase Classification, or IPC. The Israeli military operation to seize Gaza City, already underway, will likely displace hundreds of thousands of people again and worsen the already dire famine Israeli authorities have created there, largely with weapons made in and gifted by America. After announcing the plan to take over the city, the Israeli military immediately began launching intense missile strikes on Gaza City. Another Nakba. Nakba. Occupation, ethnic cleansing, apartheid, all numbingly normalized over these past 77 years. The current famine and ethnic cleansing are, in fact, tactics being used in what all leading human rights organizations and experts, including Israel's own B'Tselem, agree is an intentional genocide being carried out by the State of Israel with the full consent and support of the U.S. government and administrations of both the Democratic and Republican parties. As politicians, even progressives like Bernie Sanders, quibble over the word genocide, reading the definition ends any debate. Genocide, the deliberate killing of a large number of people from a particular nation or ethnic group with the aim of destroying that nation or group. What's happening now and has been for nearly 2 years is the normalization of genocide. I couldn't be any happier than to have with us today from Philadelphia by way of Gaza, writer and editor Ahmed Moore, who just happens to also be thinking about just this topic, the normalization of genocide. Ahmed Moore is a Palestinian-American writer born in Gaza. He's one of the Foundation for Middle East Peace's 2025 Palestinian Non-Resident Fellows and an advisory board member of the U.S. Campaign for Palestinian Rights. Ahmed is also the co-editor of After Zionism with friend of the show Anthony Lowenstein and is writing a book currently about Palestine. He also currently serves on the board of the Independence Media Foundation. Ahmed's work has been published in The Guardian, The London Review of Books, The Nation, among other outlets. He earned his Bachelor of Arts degree at the University of Pennsylvania and a Master in Public Policy at Harvard University. It is my great pleasure to welcome Ahmed Moore to Middle East in Focus.
Thank you so much for having me. It's my pleasure to be here, and I'm grateful to you for the conversations that you've been having.
Thank you. Ahmed, in March, you published an incredible essay at the Boston Review titled, "We Are Not Where We Are From." I'd like to read a short excerpt. You wrote, "In 1956, Ben-Gurion explained to Nahum Goldman the need for ongoing anti-Arab policy," quote, "Why should the Arabs make peace?" This is Ben-Gurion. "If I was an Arab leader, I would never make terms with Israel. That is natural. We've taken their country. Sure, God promised it to us, but what does that matter to them? Our God is not theirs. We come from Israel, it's true, but 2,000 years ago. And what is that to them? There has been anti-Semitism, the Nazis, Hitler, Auschwitz, but was that their fault? They only see one thing. We have come here and stolen their country. Why should they accept that?" End quote. You go on to write that in that same night, in that same late night conversation, Ben-Gurion, still Prime Minister of Israel, confided his doubts that the country, a militarized Zionist enclave in the Arab world, would endure. A remarkable concession to the utter wrongness of colonialism and militancy as a permanent way of life, end quote. So Ahmed, my question to you is, because actions do speak louder than words, do you see that being the Zionist ethos? Do you think that that is exactly what Netanyahu and his ilk know, that only near complete ethnic cleansing and either the complete denial of history or the region's full acceptance, i.e. normalization of this Zionist genocide, will allow a militarized Zionist enclave in the Arab world to continue to exist?
You know, I think, so first of all, again, thank you for the question. Thank you for having me. It's a hard topic to work through. If you look at the history of immigration to Palestine in the 20th century, there were lots of refugees who streamed into Palestine. I think that's the first thing that needs to be acknowledged. I just wrapped up a trip to Berlin, to Germany. I'm writing an essay, as I mentioned to you, over email for Jewish Currents about memory culture. And in a conversation with a Palestinian German man there, I asked him, you know, what would you do if you were a refugee, if it was 1938 and you saw the writing on the wall, what would you do with your family? The United States refused to permit Jewish immigration. Only 140,000 Jewish people were permitted to the United States. And they were fleeing a genocide as well. What would you do? I personally understand why refugees through World War II fled to Palestine. Even if you were in Germany in the 1950s and you know, the Nazis, there was continuity in that regime. They threw off the uniform and basically changed their clothes and were welcomed back into the Western fold. This is Western Germany. And if you wanted to leave Germany in the 1950s, there weren't a lot of places to go if you were a surviving Jewish person. Same with the Armenians and who escaped the genocide in Turkey. So there is a sizable Palestinian-Armenian population. The Armenian church has roots in Jerusalem, and that community has maintained continuity for a long time now. And of course, it's being threatened by the Judaization, I'd say, of Jerusalem. So I guess to try to answer your question, I want to be clear about the difference between refugees and people who sought conquest, people who sought to build something new where something already existed. And of course, that's Zionism. And so the way I interpret Zionism is it's a European, it's a local response to a local problem. So the context, the 1890s, when Zionism really gained support amongst a cohort of influential and capable people within Central Europe, within Austria, within Germany. Those people, early Zionists, were responding to anti-Semitism. We know it was there. We know it was latent. We know it was widespread, and we know that it hurt. But their response was to take a European idea, colonialism, and then graft that onto a new context. And so yes, the logic of Zionism is one in which you expel the natives, you erect a wall, and I'm referring now, of course, to the Iron Wall, Zev Jabotinsky, who is the ideological forebear for many of the people who run Israel today. You erect that wall and you arm yourself heavily and you keep the natives out, those who seek to return. And that's been Israel's operating plan for, like you said, 77 years now. But now we've arrived at a new stage in the conflict, I think, where expulsion and managing the public conversation around expulsion, which was successful for a long time, for a long time, Nakba denial, and I mean, Nakba denial is still a thing amongst our elected officials and others in positions of influence in the United States. But it's failing, that through what's apparent now in Palestine, through the genocide, the images of the genocide, Nakba denial is failing. And so I think the Israelis are faced with a choice. And I regret, I think that the choice has been made, and it's one that tends more towards extermination of Palestinians in order to consolidate, the state, to consolidate the Jewish majority in Palestine.
Yeah, and another interesting, or at least when I read it, was surprising to me is that less than 10% of the liberated Jews actually went to Palestine. There were a lot of people already by post-World War II that thought that this was not a great idea for all the reasons that we now know it was not a great idea. I wonder if you think that others, say in the American body politic, share Ben-Gurion's doubts about a militarized Zionist enclave's ability to endure in the lands that people call Israel and Palestine today.
Yeah, so I think I didn't actually know that 10%, but it resonates with everything that I've learned about, Jewish refugees coming out of Europe after the Holocaust, in the wake of the Holocaust. But there's a material component which I think is really important to think and talk about as well, which is Europe in the late 19th and early 20th century, mid 20th century, was a very, very industrialized and developed place. Many of the standards that we expect in kind of a modern place were there in the 1940s. Paved roads, electricity, flushing toilets, those kinds of things. And many of those refugees were enlisted by Zionists to move to Palestine and kind of start over and really in a totally different environment, in an agrarian context. Labor Zionism had this idea that you reclaim your personhood through working in the fields and not being kind of this urban character. And I'm avoiding a lot of the language that they used, but I mean, you can imagine today for somebody in Los Angeles, Philadelphia, or New York, you're going to move anywhere. You're going to move to Omaha, Nebraska, and you're going to become a farmer overnight. That's a tall order, irrespective of the ideological commitment. That's a big change. It's not surprising that many people didn't want to go there. But the question around militancy as such, it's in order for any colonial outpost, which is how I think about Israel today, which I do think is the most coherent framework for thinking about Israel's establishment and ongoing existence. For any colonial outpost to exist as such, it needs to have supply lines. And in the 21st century, we talk about, you know, integrated markets. And today, Israelis, Jewish Israelis, by and large, look to Europe for market access. You know, it's a small country. But also culturally and possibly even emotionally, when you think about how people relate, how they think about their lives. And so that, without that conduit that exists between Israel and Europe, and then after 67, Israel and the United States as well, and 67, June, the June War, and we can get into that, but... I would say Israel would have been much less successful than it has been in becoming this well-developed society that really has very little to do with its neighbors. You think about moving into a neighborhood. It's hard to live amongst people if you're living behind walls, unless you've got somebody who's, you know, delivering groceries. And that, you know, that's a crude analogy here, but Israel's never become integrated into the neighborhood, and it's never become integrated into the neighborhood because of that original sin, that original, the Nakba, the ethnic cleansing that occurred before, but then during 1948-49.
You're listening to Middle East in Focus on listener-supported KPFK based here in Los Angeles. I'm Esty Chandler, very happy to be joined today by the Foundation for Middle East Peace 2025 Palestinian Non-Resident Fellow, the talented Palestinian-American writer Ahmed Moore, discussing the normalization of genocide. Ahmed, you've just come back, as you alluded to, from Europe, where the Dutch foreign minister, Caspar Veldkamp, resigned just on Friday after colleagues in his cabinet blocked his push for tougher sanctions against Israel, including a proposed boycott on products made in illegal West Bank settlements. Can you talk a little bit about what you learned or observed while you were in Berlin?
Yeah, absolutely. So I was in Berlin for a week, and one of the things that was striking for me was the thinness. You hear about memory culture, this idea that if you, 2 years ago, if you had said, what is one place that has grappled with its past successfully, that has sought to learn from historical mistakes and has sought to embed those learnings within the fabric of its society, you'd have said, possibly Germany. The way that elite culture within Germany talks about the Holocaust seemed to be one way forward for societies that have grappled with really indescribable horrors. I regret that my impression coming away this time, and you can kind of see some of this from here in the United States, is that memory culture is kind of a thin construct. It's a political construct. It's skin deep. And I'm not an authority here, so I don't want to overstate my impressions or assert, you know, their validity too much. But I did meet with a Jewish Israeli woman who'd lived there in Berlin for 9 years and is a Palestine activist, anti-Zionist woman. And she moved to Berlin because she could no longer survive morally, emotionally in Israel, who told me that she needs to leave. And I'll describe the scene that I came across where we met, but I was walking up an avenue in kind of the nice part of Berlin where a lot of the government offices are, and came across a protest of 25 or 30 Jewish people, obviously Jewish people wearing the kippah, and they had signs in Hebrew, and they were conducting a protest, and there were maybe 40 or 50 German police officers, kind of riot gear, surrounding the protest with vans lined up the block. And so this is a small protest. And I learned that it was a group of Jewish Israelis who gather regularly, but they'd written their signs in Hebrew. And they were protesting the genocide with signs in Hebrew. And I want to emphasize that. And so the police, you know, I just stood there and watched as the police gathered all of the signs and first declared that this is going to be a sign-free protest. But then when these Jewish Israelis, who were kind of a unicorn, again, in that society, there aren't many Jewish people in Germany, and within that memory culture box, which is sacrosanct and sits on a really high shelf in that culture, it's a very, very special group of people. I watched as the police gathered the signs, declared that it was going to be a sign-free protest, were met with some pushback. And then finally, a Jewish Israeli woman who I interviewed, you know, the next day, was forced to stand there and translate the Hebrew signs into German to demonstrate to the police that she wasn't anti-Semitic. And so you realize how thin the learning has been at the institutional level, and I don't want to overstate it. Individuals vary in every society, and there are good people everywhere. But that was an astonishing thing to witness. And I think Germany's response to the genocide in Palestine has illustrated how Israel has been instrumentalized within German elite culture, political culture, and how little any of it has to do with a moral reckoning, which is frankly a disappointment.
Yeah, another interesting fact is that there has been for many years, brain drain happening in Israel. Educated people who don't see a future for their families. And the number one place that they have went to, Berlin.
Right.
I want to get to one other quick thing that happened this week. You wrote at The Guardian a couple weeks ago an opinion piece titled, "Palestinians Don't Need a State. We Need Justice." And you wrote, "Emmanuel Macron's decision to recognize a Palestinian state in September amounts to little. As Donald Trump noted, I don't know Macron's intentions, but the Palestinians have never really warmed to European and American condescension, which is implicit in every conditional statement, every contingent incrementalism," end quote. And I know that you and I are both fans of Drop Site News, where I heard Ryan Grimm and Sharif Abdelkoudos interview California Representative Rokana on Tuesday. And the first thing they discussed was the sign-on letter that Khanna is currently circulating for signatures amongst his colleagues on the Hill, which likewise calls for the U.S. to officially recognize Palestine as a Palestinian state, and to recognize the national aspirations of the Palestinian people. Khanna argued that in addition to Macron, 147 countries have already recognized Palestine, and that in the light of the current very, very extreme right-wing Likud government, which he pointed out, says in its charter that Israel is from the Jordan River to the Mediterranean Sea, and has members in the Israeli government who are openly talking about the annexation of Gaza and the West Bank. So Rokana says if the world doesn't come in today to collectively recognize the Palestinian state and recognize Palestinian self-determination, then they're basically complicit with the effort by Smotrich and Ben-Gvir and their ilk to deny Palestinians any hope of self-determination forever. And that's why, in his estimation, the world is mobilizing to declare it at this moment. I then looked up the definition of genocide for the opening of the show. The deliberate killing of a large number of people from a particular nation or ethnic group with an aim of destroying that nation or group. And I suddenly thought it might not just be symbolic. We only have 2 minutes, but I want your opinion about it and your thoughts on that.
Yeah, there's a tactical argument that if we recognize a Palestinian state, then the Palestinians can avail themselves of all of the international bodies through which they can seek redress and some kind of relief from occupation, apartheid, and now genocide. But my question is, why do you need a Palestinian state to come out and say, well, a genocide's occurring? Shouldn't that be the basis for any kind of legal action that you may choose to undertake or any kind of opprobrium in the media that you choose to express? There's a genocide occurring. I would argue that in light of that, you already have all of the armaments you require morally and from an argumentation point of view to go ahead and sanction Israel in a way that makes sense, in a way that's proportionate to the situation today, which is, of course, a genocidal situation or a genocide. So I don't see really the tactical value of pursuing Palestinian statehood. You already have a very bad situation that provides you with all of the tools that you need, if you're going to avail yourself of them, to go ahead and take action. My concern with the talk of Palestinian statehood, of course, Palestine's been colonized out of existence. You look at a map, you recognize there's never going to be a contiguous Palestinian state with an army, with a border, with all of those things. And in fact, it's also worth saying Israel doesn't really have a border, but that's perhaps an aside. My concern is that the discussion of Palestinian statehood really just deflects and allows those who are participating in the conversation, who are in positions of authority, to avoid responsibility for what's happening today. You are complicit in genocide. You have been complicit in the colonization and extermination of Palestinians. So what are you going to do about it? There's no need to wait for September. What are you going to do about it today, Rokana? With all respect, you know. So that's the difficulty I see with that conversation.
Yeah, and I would keep pressing that question on him because I believe wholeheartedly that he is running for president in 2028 if we have elections as the quote-unquote progressive candidate. Ahmed, it's such a pleasure to talk to you. It's even a greater pleasure to read your writing, so I encourage everybody to check it out. And I certainly look forward to having you back on the show to continue to talk about this genocide. And hopefully at some point we'll be talking about it being in the past and talk about your vision for the future.
Thank you, SC. It's been a huge pleasure. Thank you.
The normalization of this genocide has occurred through a dangerous and escalating process, including dehumanization and hate speech, political polarization, the silencing of critical voices, neutralizing the narrative, presenting conflict as complex, through systematic discrimination, ignoring decades of warning signs, and all of this has caused global moral decay and international destabilization by nearly completely destroying the systems of international law put in place as a result of the Nazi genocide of Jews in order to prevent genocide from ever happening again. Yet this genocide is led by the nation calling itself Jewish. We must all do something every day to stop the normalization of this genocide. Once again, I want to thank our guest, Ahmed Moore, Palestinian-American writer and advisory board member of the U.S. Campaign for Palestinian Rights. I also want to thank Ozzy Flamenco for his production support today. Our theme song is The Overture from Summer Night's Dream by Marcel Khalife. For KPFK Los Angeles, I'm Esty Chandler, thanking you for your continued support of KPFK and for taking this time to put the Middle East in focus.
Hi, I'm Brian DeShazer, CEO and news wrap producer of This Way Out, the international LGBTQ radio magazine. Founded in 1988 here at KPFK, we're proud to be returning to the airways after many years. You will hear summaries of news affecting LGBTQ communities around the world and features that amplify LGBTQ lives and culture. Tune in Mondays at 7:30 p.m. to This Way Out, following IMRU here on KPFK 90.7 FM Los Angeles, 98.7 FM Santa Barbara, 93.7 FM North San Diego, 99.5 FM Ridgecrest, China Lake.
This is Gary Oldman. You're listening to radio powered by the people, KPFK 90.7 FM.